The Hero Within, Redeeming the Destiny We Were Born to Fulfill. Written by Deborah L. Grassman. Printed edition published by Vandermeer Press. Narrated by Deborah Grassman. Prologue. Helping veterans face the end of their lives has been my role as a hospice and palliative care nurse practitioner with the VA healthcare system. From this vantage point, I have been given the opportunity to observe the responses of the human spirit as it struggles to bring congruity and integrity to lives that have been lived with the brokenness that is part of our human experience. I have endeavored to make the journey of these veterans my own. In the process, I have been changed. When people learn that I work with dying veterans, they will often say, "I can't imagine working in hospice." To help you imagine my everyday world, let me tell you the stories of the 9 patients on the hospice unit at the time of this writing. Then you can understand the context from which my lessons are derived. You will also understand the privilege that it is to care for veterans. Military experiences change them in fundamental ways that shape, mold, destroy, and redeem the rest of their lives. Mark is dying of liver failure from alcohol abuse, his skin yellow as a low glowing lamp. He came to the hospice unit semi-comatose. We won't get to know him except through his brother's eyes. I comment on his brother's devotion, and the brother responds, "I look at Mark and know why I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous." I listen carefully, beholding one brother willingly serving the suffering of the other. Donnie is 50 years old and has lung cancer. He's been a quadriplegic since he was 27, when an automobile accident derailed his career as a professional football player. He told me, "I spent 3 years in despair. Then I found God and salvation. I never would have found Jesus if the accident hadn't happened." Donnie's suffering had found redemption in religion. In the next room, an embittered, lonely man sits sullenly. Alcohol has estranged Zachary from his family. At age 82, he's angry at his body for failing him. He's been afraid of death since he was 10 years old when a neighbor died falling through a skylight. Bitterly, he tells me, "My only solace is in knowing that someday all the rest of you are going to be in this bed too." A gathering of team members provided a turning point as Zachary experiences the concern of the 4 staff members who were sitting at his bedside, willing to love him. Zachary went on to ask, "Why aren't we talking about my breathing and the 16 pills I'm taking?" I leaned in, daring to touch him tenderly, saying, "Because you are more than just your breathing, and we are more than just pill givers." Zachary sat quietly. A tear forms in the corner of his eye, and his features soften for the first time. Quietly, he says, "I can't argue with that." In the room next to Zachary is Marvin. He was a photographer to a general in World War II. He has been a physician, sailboat racer, and builder of piers, driveways, and roofs made with his own hands. Marvin's wife and 4 children sit at his bedside supporting his journey into the next world and supporting one another. Near death, he says little except the Lord's Prayer. There's no need for us, as a team, to intervene. We just get out of the way and behold a life well lived. In the adjoining bed is Jim, a Vietnam War veteran who has lived a colorful life. He's intermittently confused. Sometimes he's argumentative. He has no family, A few close friends are his only source of comfort. His first days on the unit were filled with agitation. He was convinced the Viet Cong had put a bomb in the stereo. Nurse Suzanne responded creatively. She called the security officer and told him, "I want you to inspect the stereo and declare it bomb-proof. Tell the patient you're pulling guards so you've got his back and the perimeter is safe. Let him know that another guard will be on patrol when you leave duty." The police officer responded convincingly with the patient, and Jim's agitation subsided. Then there's Bruce, a 67-year-old man who came in for pain control. He hadn't wanted to come to our hospice unit because he said, "I'm afraid I'll never get out." His early days of anxiety and impatience were manifested with frequent summons on the call light, probably because he realizes he's in a safe, loving environment. His spirit is now emerging bright and full. He simply needed a little time and a little love to know that he need not fear. He has grown closer to his family as he approaches death, and he tells us, "I wouldn't trade these last few weeks in my life for anything." Bruce's roommate, Richard, suffers respiratory distress from a tumor encroaching on his breathing tube. He awaits his daughter's arrival from Indiana tomorrow. He says his suffering will be redeemed when he can rejoin his wife who died 2 years ago. With tears, he proclaims, "That will be a happy day." We share his anticipated joy. Ben has a history of drug use and actively continues with alcohol abuse. He identifies himself as a loner who has witnessed much violence. He told me that his family doesn't care about him. We've had some difficult sessions confronting his suffering. He's going to be discharged next week. I don't know what's going to happen with him. What I can tell you is that his brow unfurls after prayer. He plans to go to Alcoholic Anonymous meetings, and he wants to reach out to a faith community. Seeds planted and good intentions, however, are still not enough to withstand the ravages of alcohol. Ben's redemption awaits a courageous decision that only he can make every day for the rest of his life. The last patient, Edwin, has severe chronic respiratory disease and is ready to die, but he worries about his wife of 54 years. His needs are increasing rapidly, but he doesn't acknowledge them because he doesn't want to worry her. But he tells me, "I can't hold on much longer," while he makes plans to hold on for his wife's sake. We talk about the advantage of letting go so he can prepare himself and his wife for his death. We talk about the damage that his denial is causing them both. Edwin cries as his grieving begins. Stories of sacrifice in the name of love are always worth beholding. As these stories depict, paradoxically, there's probably more intense living on the hospice unit than in most of our own lives. In my first book, Peace at Last, Stories of Hope and Healing for Veterans and Their Families, I wrote about veterans like the ones cited above. I told how they experience healing as they near the end of their lives. I've used the proceeds from the sale of that book to give more than 2,000 books to veterans. However, my own gift is frequently reciprocated with generosity. For example, I noted a World War II volunteer helping staff at a Jacksonville hospice event. Sleight of frame and doddering in gait, he set up food trays, opened doors, and performed clerical duties. After I had completed signing books for participants, the volunteer handed me a $20 bill. I protested, saying, "Oh no, you don't need to pay for your book. It was my gift to you." He smiled kindly, saying, "You gave me a book last year when you were here. This year, I want to pay for my book so that you can buy more books for your veterans." I could only smile and accept this 88-year-old man's graciousness. These acts, small as they may seem, are not small acts. They perpetuate a grace and energy that propel the work that I do. At another hospice event, a funeral home director told me that he had worked with two different families who had lost sons in the Iraq War. He said, "I bought each family one of your books. Both of them called me later to say how much it helped." I handed him two more books, saying, "Find two more families for these two books." "You mean it?" he said incredulously. I responded, "I would feel honored for you to do so." He cried. I could only sit and marvel at the love and sense of responsibility that he felt toward the veterans he served. His was a gift much greater than the two books I had just given him. I was getting on an airplane and noted a Vietnam vet by the insignia on his hat. Unfortunately, my books were in a checked suitcase. After we deplaned, I kept the veteran in view as we approached baggage claim. His suitcase came before mine, so I tried to detain him, saying, "Wait, sir, don't leave yet. I have something I want to give you." He looked at me with suspicion, probably worried I was going to sell him something. Luckily, I spied my suitcase inching toward me on the carousel. I pleaded, "Really, sir, hold on, just for a minute." I ripped open my suitcase and produced the mysterious gift I referenced. He accepted the book readily enough, but warily looked over its cover until he saw the words, "Stories of Hope and Healing for Veterans and Their Families." I explained, "I wrote this book for you. I want you to have it." He said with sad guardedness, "You wrote this book for me? I'm a Vietnam vet. No one's ever done anything for me." "Sincerely," I replied, "I know. I love Vietnam vets. You are the exact reason I wrote this book." He looked at me carefully. "You're really the author of this book?" I laughingly replied, "I really am, sir." He dropped his head and then fumbled in his pocket, producing a pen, saying, "Then would you please autograph it for me? I never knew anyone who really cared about us." I took his pen and inscribed my hope for his peace. 6 months later, my website received a message from this man's son. It read, "You gave my father a copy of your book at the luggage terminal at the Louisville airport last year. He had the Vietnam vet hat and lots of tattoos. My father couldn't sleep that night at our lake house, which is nothing new, so he started reading your book. He told me he cried, which is something he rarely does. He said he finally realized he has PTSD. I would like to thank you personally for sharing your insight and helping those who are suffering." Though I've had these kinds of responses countless times, I'm still enthralled and humbled every time they occur. I had given a book to another Vietnam vet who sought me out when I was presenting in a nearby city. He said, "I had to find you to tell you what a difference your book made." I said nothing, waiting for him to proceed. He said, "I've always been ashamed of my service in Vietnam. I took my uniform off in the airport as soon as I came stateside. Only my family knows I served there. Now, I'm letting the secret out. I'm no longer ashamed, and I'm proud. Thanks to you, I don't have to hide anymore." He could only cry and hug me. I could only cry and accept his grateful homecoming. These moments are profound. They are profound because they signify shifts in perspective that precipitate healing. I have had hundreds of veterans tell me how their hearts have been opened because the words on the pages bring peace to their hearts. Their peace has brought me great joy. However, it can sometimes feel overwhelming, as portrayed in the next two stories. Buzz was a World War II veteran who came to see me after he had read Peace at Last. He lived locally and sought me out on the hospice unit. He carried a German war helmet in his hands. It had a bullet hole with cracks radiating outward. Haltingly, he handed me the helmet. I was reluctant to accept it until he told me the story of how he had acquired it. Carefully choosing his words, he said, "I was a company commander on maneuvers in Germany near the Dachau concentration camp. We were digging a trench when we uncovered a foxhole with the remains of a German soldier, this helmet, a rifle, and pieces of a parachute. The rifle was dismantled, so the German soldier must have been cleaning his weapon and was surprised by an American soldier." I looked at Buzz unknowingly. I wasn't grasping the significance of the details he was offering. Buzz explained, "He shouldn't have been shot. He should have been ordered to surrender." Still, I was perplexed. "But you weren't there, Buzz. How do you know what happened?" Buzz's voice became low, and it was hard for me to understand him at first. He said, "I don't know what happened, but I can imagine because I know what I saw." I took the helmet home with me as a reminder. I still didn't understand. "A reminder of what, Buzz? I don't understand what you're saying." He explained, "Guilt. I took on the guilt for what was done to him. I felt I had to. We shouldn't have shot him. We should have taken him prisoner. Then he'd still be alive today. I've kept this helmet in my closet for 60 years. I haven't told this to another soul. But after I read your book, I had to let you know that I've decided to let the guilt go. I had to find you to let you know the heaviness in my chest is gone, and I feel free now." I could only feel wonder and relief as I felt the weight of the load that he had carried for so long. Although his guilt seemed irrational, there was a rational motive behind it. As he hugged me, I whispered, "Thank you for caring about the death of that German soldier, Buzz. Thank you for holding the space of forgiveness in the American heart for him. You've carried the guilt long enough. I'm glad you've decided you can let it go now." Like Buzz, guilt weighed heavily on Barry, another World War II veteran. Barry lived at a state veterans home. A hospice provides end-of-life care at the facility. They give a copy of my book to every veteran upon admission. The staff also asked me to train them in how to better care for dying veterans. They wanted me to meet with Barry because he had aggressive and combative behaviors that had caused his removal from one section of the veterans home. I met with the 92-year-old veteran along with 10 hospice staff who were observing the interaction. Barry had read my book and he was eager to meet me. Initially, Barry and I talked about his relationship with his three estranged sons and his anger at being confined to a nursing home. Then I asked him about his military service. Proudly, he responded, "Want to hear about my 3 Purple Hearts and 2 Bronze Stars?" Gently, I replied, "No, we can talk about your medals later. Right now, I'd be interested in hearing about things from World War II that might still be troubling you now." Barry's pride quickly turned to hostility. Fiercely, he said, "All of it," wheeling quickly around to bring his face close into mine. I said nothing, but my eyes opened in surprise, and I motioned for him to go on. Intently, he brought his hand out as if it were a gun, putting his forefinger in the middle of my forehead, pushing my head back. He said, "Do you know what it's like to put a gun in the middle of a forehead and pull the trigger?" Even though I had heard these kinds of stories from other veterans, I was unprepared for the intensity and directness with which he had responded. I summoned inner strength so that I could remain steadfast. His eyes never diverted from mine. I shook my head, no, acknowledging that I didn't know what that was like. In a taunting manner, he asked, "You want to hear more now?" I didn't indicate yes or no. I simply remained open to the anger and bitterness he was directing toward me. Then he challenged me. "Want to hear more of what I did?" I met his steely blue eyes that were piercing my soul with a steady gaze that belied the inner quaking I was experiencing as I imagined the horror that he had seen and done. Again, I said nothing, but my unwavering gaze let him know I could take it. Barry then retracted his stance slightly and told me he and a buddy had been ordered to patrol an occupied city. The names of the occupants were posted on the doors of the houses. They had gone into one house, however, and found three teenage boys whose names were not on the list. Barry said, "They weren't supposed to be there. They were just lying on their beds, jeering at us with their arms behind their heads. The other soldier I was with asked me what we should do with them. I told him that we gotta peel them." "You know what that means?" I narrowed my eyes quizzically, indicating that I didn't know what he meant. Barry came close to my face, pushing back the bill of his army hat so he could get even closer to me. He said, "You split their heads open with the bullet. Their brains come out." Tears came to my eyes as I imagined the shockingly intimate carnage. Barry jeered at my innocence. "Yeah, you see? Want to hear more now?" I shook my head no, saying, "I can't hear any more. I've heard all I can hear." Seconds ticked by as we sat locked together in silent wartime memories. The room was reeling, and I wasn't sure what to do next. Instinctively, I placed my hand firmly on his heart while my eyes peered closely into his soul, a place beyond the anger and venom he was spewing forth. I said, "Barry, I am so sorry that you were put in a position to see and do the things that you had to see and do at that young, tender age. I am so sorry that you had to experience that." I felt Barry relax under my hand. Then tears came to his eyes, and we cried together. After a time, he reported that he felt shaky inside. I replied, "That's okay, Barry. Let yourself shake. Just breathe deeply as you shake. Breathe and shake, and we will all breathe and shake with you." Barry had great trust in the chaplain, so I motioned for Chaplain Verne to stand behind Barry and encircle him in a hug that could contain the trembling. I motioned for the other staff to draw in closely as well. I said, "Barry, we're here to encircle you with love while Chaplain Verne prays for you. Is that okay with you?" Barry indicated consent, and Chaplain Verne prayed for peace in Barry's soul. Barry continued to cry and shake, even making low, guttural noises. Afterward, he looked up with amazement at the team surrounding him, a team who had the courage to bear witness to his story. A look of relief came over Barry's face. Softness crept in to replace his furrowed and fierce brow. Marie, a Vietnam War veteran who is one of my colleagues and had traveled with me, came forward. She said, "Barry, I have a pin I want to honor you with." She showed him an American flag pin inscribed with the words, "Honored Veteran." Barry remained silent, but held his gaze into Marie's eyes. She said, "Barry, you deserve this. You have carried the guilt long enough. It took a lot of courage to do what you did here today. I want you to have this." Marie pinned his shirt collar and then enveloped him in a hug. Once again, Barry cried. In fact, all of us did, We were witnessing a soldier brought home from war at last. Barry maintained his softness for the many months he lived. He was smiling and even seemed lighthearted. He reconciled with two of his sons. Staff members were astounded with the change in him. I was not surprised by the change. Combat is like that. It can create mean and ugly places in people's souls. And those places can be covered up during much of a person's life. At the end of life, however, redemption awaits if people have the courage to avail themselves of the opportunity, the way Barry did. I didn't always know about the redemption of suffering at the end of life, or at any other time in life for that matter. When I first became a nurse 30 years ago, I was naive and thought I could eradicate my patients' suffering. By rescuing them, I thought I would become a hero. Now, I realize that suffering is inevitable, and that heroism arises when I dare to encounter its distress. More importantly, I learned that I couldn't help my patients' suffering until I learned how to encounter my own. Ironically, it was my patients who taught me how to cultivate courage so that I could face affliction. They have been my heroes, showing me how to navigate through the labyrinth they courageously face at the end of their lives. I'm certainly not the hero I had originally envisioned when I started my nursing career, and my path has been everything except what I anticipated. This unimagined experience is fortunate, because the unexpected experience has yielded treasures I would have otherwise never known. This second book is about those treasures. Although the context for many of the stories is provided by my experience with veterans, this book is not about veterans. The principles are applicable to anyone, veterans and non-veterans alike. Suffering and its redemption are universal. Accessing the interior hero is an assignment we are all tasked to fulfill.